This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The current session of the North Carolina General Assembly is nearing an end. This week, the House and Senate reached agreement on a tax reform plan that would lower corporate and personal income tax rates. Republicans hailed it as a step in the right direction. Opponents say the cuts will fall on the backs of middle and low-wealth families. We expected that lawmakers will reach agreement on the budget as well today. And in the meantime, Republicans rolled out a new, stricter version of a controversial voter ID plan yesterday. Talk about all of that on today's News Roundtable, starting with Dan Barkin, senior editor at the News and Observer. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, how you doing, Frank?
Doing great. So we had two versions of this, a House and Senate version of a tax reform plan. Now we have one expected to pass. What's in it?
Well, it's not the broad major reform that a lot of people were hoping for and that Phil Berger, the Senate leader, was trumpeting and Pat McCrory was talking about. I think it's mostly a tax cut bill. I pulled out my 2012 tax form and tried to sort of figure out how I'm doing, and I don't think I'm going to know until a couple of Aprils from now.
Yeah, well, it all depends on whether you buy that yacht that you're...
Well, I've had my eye on one, but I don't know if I can work it out this year.
So I'm making reference to a couple of the loopholes that were left in. When you say it's not all that it's that many had hoped for, one of the things that was hoped for and certainly was part of the Senate plan was a broad coverage, a broad spectrum of sales taxes on services, covering most of the services in the state. And as your paper pointed out today, there are about 300 exemptions and loopholes in the current tax code, and only about 48 of them were filled. So give us a sense of what was and what wasn't without going through each item.
Well, I think that basically they eliminated a couple of loopholes, some really obscure, having to do with, chiropractors and, franchise fees and these sorts of things. But I think that what happened was they got up to the edge and they lost their nerve. So there's still loopholes for NASCAR and U.S. Airways and a whole range of other things. It got so bad at one point that Bob Rucho, who was the chief tax writer in the Senate and a big advocate of broad-based tax reform, he quit. He quit his chairmanship. They talked him back, but it was pretty contentious.
Right. And I guess we should point out specifically that the reference I made is that there is now a cap of $1,500 on the sales tax that you will pay if you buy a yacht or a jet in this state.
Now, one of the things that they are doing is they're capping mortgage interest rate payment deduction. So you can only take up to $20,000 for mortgage interest and property tax deductions. And mortgage interest has been the third rail that a lot of legislatures and Congress have wanted to stay away from. So that was pretty significant. That will affect people who have mortgages on pretty expensive homes. So I was kind of surprised to see that because the real estate lobby in this state, as in many states, is very powerful.
Right.
So. The Republicans can take credit for that.
Right. So when you say they lost their nerve, they, of course, lost their nerve when the various lobbyists reminded them how important they were to their campaigns, et cetera. But as you suggest, this one very powerful lobby, developers and realtors, didn't win in this particular case. And also what the part of the Rucho package included an increase in the sales tax on food and medicine that didn't go through in this plan.
Or on Social Security if mortgage interest is the third rail, that's the sort of double third rail, and so I think it was sort of very difficult to pull the trigger on some of these broad-based sales tax changes, basically covering everything, food, prescription drugs, a whole raft of services, and they just couldn't do it. And if you can't do that, then you're really not talking about broad-based reform, because our tax code is still pretty much written for 80 years ago, and we were much more heavily a manufacturing economy instead of a service economy. So to a great extent, services still aren't taxed.
Which gets to your point earlier, the initial point that you made, that it, to you, it doesn't look much like tax reform. It's just tax cuts, because personal and corporate income tax were indeed reduced.
Now, they're going to declare victory and go home. And so everybody's going to spin it. The Republicans, in the main, are crossing their fingers that the economy is going to continue to grow over the next 4 or 5 years, because they have punched a hole in the state's revenue base, and they're hoping that they'll be able to have economic growth generate more revenue.
All right. So that gets to the other side of this. You cut taxes, you need to make it up somewhere, and you need to make a budget based on what you expect those revenues to be. And we're going to hear probably later today what's in that budget. Any idea, Dan, what we might hear?
Well, we're going to hear some of it. I don't think we're going to see the many of the nuts and bolts of it until it goes online Sunday night. But we'll get some of it today online, and then in print in the paper tomorrow. And you know, so there are some the overall number, about $20.6 billion, is about the same in the House and the Senate, but there have been some real differences in that $20.6 billion, as you can imagine, from teaching assistance to eugenics payments to class size limits. All throughout the budget, the House and Senate have been going round and round. And so to me, the last act of this legislature is going to be how it all comes out. And we'll hear some of it today, this afternoon, later on, and we'll see some of it over the weekend.
I want to get to a couple of other topics that are in the news this week. And in your paper, your paper did an article recently about the Rural Center, a center that's supposed to bring development to rural areas, economic development to rural areas of the state. Your paper wrote about the large severance that its director received after stepping down, forced to step down after an audit showed irregularities in the way they were spending their money. Now their budget is frozen. Tell us the story of the Rural Center.
Well, this was created in 1987 as leaders like Jim Hunt and others saw the jobs leaving rural areas, textiles going overseas, furniture jobs, furniture plants shutting down. And they knew they had a really serious problem on their hands. So the counties were starting to hollow out, and we were evolving to two North Carolinas, one urban and prosperous and one rural and poor. And so they set this up with the best of intentions. What Andy Curlis, our reporter, did in his two-part series was look at what they've been doing, and there were some real questions about whether the money was really being spent wisely, and whether they were creating good jobs, or even knew whether they were creating jobs. And so this ran as a two-part series, and then that was followed up by, at the same time, Beth Woods was doing an audit, which...
Who is the state auditor?
Which, interestingly enough, was not really known outside of her office and the Rural Center that this audit was going on. Subsequently, this audit pops out, which basically restates a lot of the material that Andy had documented, but also noted that the Billy Ray Hall had been given a
the director of the rural center.
The director had been given a $250,000 golden parachute, so that when he left, he would walk away with around $240,000 to $250,000, which was eye opening to say the least. So Billy Ray Hall resigns, Yesterday, Art Pope, the state budget director, delivers a letter saying that he's freezing state money, which is most of what the rural center gets, and they may start clawing back old money that went to the center. Now it's in the middle of the budget because the House has been pushing for full funding, and Phil Berger, the Senate leader, wants to cut them off and divert this money to state agencies. So one of the things that we're going to see in the budget is, you know, what happens to the rural center.
Right. And we should point out that the auditor, Beth Woods, as you said, is a Democrat. So for the record.
This is a difficult issue because North Carolina's rural areas are hurting badly and they need help. And this is not a good thing going on right now for rural areas.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about the General Assembly as it nears its close. We'll look at the tax package, speculate about the budget, and talk about other issues, including voter ID. With us now, Dan Barkin, senior editor at the News and Observer. Just ahead, we'll take a closer look and talk with more folks on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about tax reform, the budget, taking a look back at this session of the General Assembly. No, they're still at it, but they're winding down. With us, Dan Barkin, senior editor at the News and Observer. Joining us now is Frank Roche. He is the host of the Frank Roche Show on WFXR Radio and WFXRradio.com, adjunct professor of economics at Elon University, and the author of two books, The Five Structural Barriers to American Strength and Prosperity, and FX, A Day Trader's Guide to the Foreign Exchange Market. Frank, welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also with us in the studio, Rob Schofield, a policy director at NC Policy Watch. Rob, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Frank.
Frank, let's start with you. What do you think about this tax reform package?
Well, I think it's the Republicans following through somewhat on their campaign promises. I was listening to your conversation in the earlier segment, and I would have to agree this is not tax reform in the way they've suggested it would be on the campaign trail. As you know, the premise of the Republican position has been about moving towards a consumption tax, away from the income tax. That's a dirty process, and it's going to take a little while. Their first step was tepid at best, and it ends up being a tax reduction package, which, of course, I support, and I think they're following through on the pledge they put through on their campaign trail, which was we're going to reduce the tax burden on North Carolinians. Now, the other point we need to make real quickly is the whole idea is revenue supposed to be revenue neutral. So we reduce the income tax burden, but we raise the sales tax burden. Absent that balance, you're never going to get your tax reform. The political realities came confronting in their face with special interests, and they backed off.
What do you think, Rob?
Really a worst of all worlds deal, because it raises taxes effectively on about 80% of the population and yet cuts revenues to the state on the order of $500, even up to $650 million down the road per year. So we're going to have less money for services, but people are going to be paying more. People at the bottom, people at the middle. The incidence analysis done by the expert shows that while you can cherry pick examples of people whose taxes for, say, you're making $40,000 a year, your tax might go down a tiny bit. Overall, the vast majority of people in the bottom 80%, their taxes are actually going to go up with the demise of the earned income tax credit, with the slight broadening of the sales tax base. And the people at the top, the people who were already paying a lower percentage of their income in state and local taxes combined, are going to pay even less, thousands of dollars less, and bring in less money to the state. So worst of all worlds.
Not the worst, because you could have increased the sales tax on food, which is the most highly regressive tax for people on a fixed income. If all you've got is $20,000 a year and your money, the money you spend on food is fixed. So not the worst.
No, there's got to be a distinction here, though. Actually, tax rates are going down. What he's referring to is the effective tax rate we'll all pay. The effective tax rate is going to change because deductions change.
Right.
You'll know very few Americans ever pay their actual tax rate. Their effective tax rate is always below their tax rate. What we're doing here is doing what we say. When you want to talk about an efficient tax code, when you want it to be simpler, that means reducing deductions. That means simplifying the code. That means the difference between the tax rate and your effective tax rate must fall. So he's right to say the tax bill will be higher, but tax rates are not going up. That is factually incorrect.
But the tax bill.
What you pay is exactly right. So your effective tax rate.
You're
going to
end up paying a little bit more, especially as in the middle and lower income levels and as a percentage of your income, A. And B, it's not going to be revenue neutral, which means the state's going to have to make it up somehow, which is probably in cuts and services.
Right.
And the other, let me ask you about that, Frank. I mean, let me ask you about the multiplier effect. I mean, when you collect tax, I mean, the whole idea is you're going to make this state more business friendly. You're going to generate revenue because you're going to have more jobs and business. But when you collect taxes, you don't throw it into a furnace. You actually spend it back into your economy. Taxes cannot always be a dirty word for a state.
No, it's not. It never should be. We need taxes to function as a society.
So what about this? What about the fact that it's not revenue neutral? Are you worried that it's actually going to hurt?
Well, on their analysis, it is revenue neutral because they have a multiplier effect that suggests as we reduce the tax burden on the economy, therefore we get greater output and therefore we get greater increases in actual collections. That's the idea for revenue neutral. It's at risk. Absolutely at risk because they don't know what the future economic output for the North Carolina economy is going to be any more than I do or you do sitting right here at this table today. It's a reasonable assumption to make. There's evidence in the past that you can lower taxes and get increased revenues, no question about it. But they are not filling both sides of the gap. Now, keep in mind, they're lowering taxes and the first McCrory budget is going to be higher than the prior budget. The operating budget from Pat McCrory is going to be over $20 billion. The last Purdue budget was $19.8 billion.
Dan Barkin, Dan Barkin?
That's an increase of 3.5%.
Dan at the NNL?
That's an interesting point. Yeah, he raises an interesting point, which is the point that Phil Berger has been making, which is that in the next 5 years, the actual revenues of the state may grow about 15%, and that what we're doing is slowing the growth of government. I have never seen what they're doing in Raleigh as a revolution this past 6 months. I've seen it as kind of a slow turning of the ship. They've been nibbling around the edges and making some hot-button cuts with teacher assistants, but I don't see this as a really dramatic change in the way the state budget looks.
Well, something that's very important, I hope doesn't get lost in this. Rob, you made reference to it quickly, but I'd like to spend more time on it. The fact that the earned income tax credit is allowed to sunset. In other words, the earned income tax credit, which was a real benefit to wage earners at the lowest end of the spectrum, that benefit is now gone.
Right. This put tens of millions of dollars in the pockets of people at the bottom who pay taxes but may not have paid much in the way of income tax every year. These are people who generally pay more of their income in taxes, all taxes combined, than people at the top. It was originally, of course, a Ronald Reagan idea. Many states had moved to adopt it throughout the 1990s and 2000s. North Carolina was a relative latecomer to that, but it had injected significant funds into the pockets of people who would spend that money immediately. And now we're saying, sorry about that, that's going away. So that's an effective tax hike on those people at the bottom who are these are working families, people with working income who are struggling, making like $20,000 a year.
Well, and this also for veterans and military families, this has implications in a state that has a strong military economic base.
In fact, I think the number is 64,000 military families actually took advantage of the state earned income tax credit and will now no longer get that. So it's pretty remarkable from my perspective, the shift, the great tax shift that's going on here from the top to the bottom, paired with a reduction in state revenue.
What about Frank?
Yeah, when you're talking about this particular aspect of the tax code, if you look at the empirical evidence over the past 20, 25 years, the earned income tax credit has really not done what it was supposed to do. It hasn't engendered greater economic output. In fact, we can look at a variety of statistics that indicate that the people at the lowest end of the income spectrum continue to suffer in the faces of these continued tax reductions.
I agree with that. People
now,
at the bottom
the
are suffering.
The key element here is cash flows. Think of this in terms of cash flow. Through the year, these low-income earners are not impacted by the earned income tax credit. They pay their taxes as they go. So they're not. There's no new burden on them as a result of taking this away during their tax year. They get that money in the following year in a lump sum. So they are paying their way through the prior year. There will be an adjustment for these individuals, no question about it. But in terms of cost-benefit analysis, risk-reward analysis, the earned income tax credit could be taken out of every state. It should be taken out of the federal government. It's one of those deductions most easily taken out of the code if you want to simplify the code. It's impactful. There's no denying it. People that were getting that money will not get that money. But it's a cash flow issue more than anything else.
Well, okay. But don't you then, Frank, have to compensate for that? These are people who are working. They're at the low end of the spectrum. If they have the money in their pocket, whether it's once a year or throughout the year, they will spend it. And they will no doubt spend it locally. They're not going to invest it in a portfolio likely to go to China and India. They're going to spend it in Wilson, North Carolina, in Brunswick County. So one way or another, and if you think the earned income tax credit isn't a good way because of the way it sets up cash flow, find another way to keep that money in their pocket because they're spending it locally and, frankly, they need it.
Yeah. Well, and one way we're attempting to do that is lowering the income tax rate. Of course, the other side instantly is this increase in the sales rate, which is going to impact them negatively. It's a very difficult thing. What we're trying to do is move pieces around the board. This is an allocation of a huge pool of money without focus on the individuals and the individual impact on each one. To suggest that any tax code, either at the federal level, state, or local level, is fair or ever will be fair, I think is fanciful. Some people always benefit more than others, and that's in every area of our life, and it always will be the case.
But we clearly have to try to make it more fair, and what we're doing here is making it less fair. I'm with you on we need to get rid of all these deductions and loopholes, but if the price of doing that is that we're not going to truly broaden the base and lower the rates, which was the other presupposed aspect of this, and truly keep things revenue neutral, which we're clearly not. McCrory has broken his promise there as well. Then what are we doing? We're coming up with a tax code that's less fair and brings in less money. Again, a worst of all worlds solution.
Well, let me ask you this from the market standpoint, just from a market point of view, supply and demand. We had a show just the other day that talked about the value of a college education. And we had a guest on here who went in. She got a master's in public health because she recognized that there were public health disparities and people at the low end of the economic spectrum were suffering from chronic illnesses. They weren't getting treated. It was a drain on the economy, but mostly it was hurting them. And that's why she got into it. Public health, she gets her degree. She sees the need. There is a demand for good public health service. She gets out. There are no jobs. Well, there's no jobs because the only way to pay for public health is through the public treasury, and nobody's paying for it. Just in terms of supply and demand, if the state was to raise enough money to pay that student instead of making donuts, and by the way, the best in Durham, instead of having her do that, that she had a job in public health, wouldn't she be meeting a demand? Wouldn't that demand ultimately lead to lower costs because people aren't going to emergency rooms, they're not ending up in the criminal justice system because they're only working part of the time, et cetera? Isn't that an investment that actually meets a need and meets the demand that our economy is asking for? I'm asking, but let me ask Frank.
Yeah, you can jump in. It's a very nice scenario you just painted. It doesn't really match up with real life. And the suggestion that we should take tax dollars to fund a job for someone in public health because they pursued that particular career in college and they need a job in that field, regardless of what you think the multiplier effect is, you're taking money for someone else just to give someone else a job. That's the simplicity of that.
Well,
is what public work is about. You are taking money from others that work in the private sector, you're using that money to hire other individuals. That is a game loser. Long term, that cannot sustain itself. I cite Detroit as your best example against this type of thinking. They've been thinking about that, using money to create jobs in Detroit for decades and decades and decades.
But Frank's
not sustainable in the long run.
Well, let me ask Rob, go ahead.
You're not saying that you want to create that job just to help this particular woman. You want to create this job to improve our society, the common good. I mean, there are all kinds of investments we make.
But the common good, you're taking that money from someone else who's working.
Well, now let Rob finish.
Because
it does have to do with the impact on public health and the ultimate cost to all of us by ignoring
this. Of course, or investing. You could make the same argument for investing in public education and hiring good teachers, investing in higher education. Our society has no hope. North Carolina has no hope in the long run of succeeding in the 21st century if we're not going to invest in these basic public structures and services that make a middle-class society possible. If we're going to follow the Mississippi-Texas model, where we essentially eradicate government or eviscerate government, we're going to end up like them. We're going to be like Texas and Mississippi with even more haves and have-nots and a society that has no chance to compete on a global scale.
And you find me any data that shows any reduction in government spending in Texas, United States of America, North Carolina, I'll give you $100.
I'll send you.
You will not find the data. There is no drop in spending. There's just an increase in revenue. That's what helps Texas balance its books.
I'll send you an email.
Spending is not falling anywhere
Here's, I'll send Dennis an email.
Here's, even North Carolina.
No, well, actually, it has fallen in the last 4 years.
There are witnesses to that bet.
Gentlemen,
I take that bet back.
Gentlemen, back to our show. I just want to ask you this, though. Here's what's interesting. North Carolina and Texas often are one and two in business environment, and this was before the tax cuts. So whatever our tax environment was in 2012, it made us number one in business climate, according to Site Selection magazine. Number one. Right. Texas, number two. So you know, you can, who knows what's going on there, but apparently taxes weren't brutal enough to keep businesses
I'll
out.
I'll tell you, can
third
I jump
best,
in real quickly?
Third, can I just,
yeah, go ahead.
Third
Sorry,
best
Frank.
In the state, Chief Executive Magazine, fourth best in the country, best state for business 2012, Forbes Magazine, fourth best in the country in 2012, according to CNBC. So at least, at the very least, we were doing okay with the antiquated tax code that we had.
Can I jump in here, Frank?
Go ahead, Dan, because this all appeared. Rob Christensen actually put all this together in a piece in your paper, so go ahead and do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the question about, because one of the justifications for changing the tax code has been competitiveness with in attracting industry and job formation. And that's an interesting question at the margins, because I suppose in cases like states like Illinois, which are losing businesses because of their onerous tax structure, that's probably the case. In making business decisions about whether to move a plant from Pennsylvania to North Carolina, I'm always interested in where the tax issue sort of resides in the decision making. I mean, I've worked for private businesses my whole career and been involved in capital budgeting decisions and expansion decisions. And, you know, a lot of times the first question you ask is, you know, can we expand our business? Can we sell more? Is aggregate demand up? And the tax issue is not that prominent in those discussions. In this state, sometimes I think that we talk about that, but, I seldom really see any empirical evidence of how critical that is in job formation.
Yeah, and we have to say that in that same article in Rob Christensen's commentary, he also said that all the time that North Carolina's ranked one or two or three, it was ranked 44th in tax climate. So, Frank, that is my question, and kind of what Dan said. Tax is certainly a part of it, but they cannot, if this evidence is true, it can't be the most important thing to a business, right?
Yeah, and those analyses are very helpful. They look at tax rates. What Dan is getting at and what we haven't touched on yet is the giveaways prior to companies coming into the state. It isn't just about giveaways in terms of the tax liability have over a certain period of time once they get started. It's also giveaways on land acquisition. It's also giveaways on permits related to development. It's also it's on the margin for these companies, but it's enough to entice them. Of course, North Carolina benefits from our great roads and the great university infrastructure that we have. But North Carolina is at the front of the line giving back to corporations when it comes to tax liabilities, land giveaways, environmental regulations, things like this. This is what they do behind the scenes to attract people to the states. The tax rate, you can't just look at that. You have to look at the giveaways below.
All right. And thus, the rationale for the decision to cut taxes even more falls further by the wayside.
All right. We've got only about 3 minutes left, and I've got to get to the politics of this budget because Senator Tom Apodaca quoted or he referred to an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal this week praising North Carolina for lowering its taxes. That would have been enough to say the Wall Street Journal is happy that North Carolina is lowering its taxes, but they weighed in on a political battle here. This piece by Stephen Moore says, more than anyone, Mr. Berger, Phil Berger, president of the Senate, gets credit for making the cuts happen when it looked like they might die. The deal was held up in the House for more than a month, in part because the Republican Speaker Tom Tillis fretted about revenue loss. It sounds like Dan Barkin, let me start with you, that he's weighing in on the nomination battle between these two Republicans for the right to run against Kay Hagan.
Well, you know, Tillis has not set the world on fire as far as running for the Senate. I honestly don't know if Phil Berger really wants to run for the Senate. I think that he would probably much more enjoy being state attorney general. But there's no question that Phil probably enjoys pushing Tom Tillis's buttons on this, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why he's waiting. You're talking about guys who come from very different places. Phil is a, you know, really sort of grassroots, almost kind of populist guy from a small town, you know, in Eden, North Carolina. Tillis is, an urban guy from Charlotte, spent a big chunk of his career at IBM. Very different worldviews, very different outlooks. And, I think that this is really kind of shaping the culture of the various chambers.
Well, Frank, how much a part do you think politics has played
in
this
playing, whole session? By the way, Stephen Moore, the author of that article, he's a player in North Carolina politics behind the scene. He's invited amongst the important people in North Carolina. So he knows what's going on here, and he advises as such. That is Stephen Moore getting involved in the political process. So we have the leader of the Senate, the leader of the House, both running for Senate. One has the current advantage. That's Tillis over Berger. It sounds like Stephen's endorsing Berger. Not a huge surprise. Tom's not quite Stephen Moore's cup of tea. But it's sad that our two leaders right now are caught up being paid, doing legislative things, and also focused on the
Senate. I agree,
Senate.
And I
don't
think,
like it.
And I think Kay Hagan would be happy to run against either one, actually.
She's going to get crushed.
On the state of things.
We'll have to discuss that on another
show. She's going
to
get crushed.
We are out of time. Can't follow up on that one. Frank Roche, host of The Frank Roche Show, WFXR, WFXR.com, adjunct professor at Elon, the author of two books, The Five Structural Barriers to American Strength and Prosperity, FX, a day Trader's Guide to Foreign Exchange. I want to thank you, Rob Schofield, Policy Director at NC Policy Watch, Dan Barkin, Senior Editor at The News and Observer. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank.
Enjoyed it.
Coming up, the music of Many Nights Ahead, just ahead. Stay tuned.